Pull up a chair. I want you to put yourself in a cockpit for a minute. It's the middle of the night, the 16th of May, 1943. You're flying a four-engine bomber the size of a barn, and you're doing it at 60 feet, not 600, 60, low enough that the slipstream is whipping the tops off the hedgerows below you, low enough that a single power line, a single church steeple, a single moment of inattention, and there is no recovery. None. You're already in the ground. Now hold that picture. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and you're listening to The Hangar, where we sit around and tell the stories that made this whole business of flying what it is. And today we're going to talk about one of the most audacious, half-mad, brilliant raids in the history of military aviation, Operation Chastise. The men who flew it earned a name that stuck for the rest of their lives, the Dam Busters. Now before I get rolling, let me tell you who keeps the lights on around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone you hit in this flying life. Your first solo, your private ticket, instrument rating, commercial, all the way up the ladder. If you earned it, they've got a coin that marks it, and every one of them tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. A coin in your pocket is a better souvenir than a logbook stamp, and it lasts a whole lot longer. All right, let's get into it. To understand this raid, you have to start with a man who never flew a combat mission in his life. His name was Barnes Wallace, an engineer, a quiet, stubborn, tweed jacket sort of Englishman who thought about problems the way the rest of us worry a loose tooth. And the problem Barnes Wallace was chewing on was this. Germany's war machine ran on industry, and that industry sat in the Ruhr Valley, and that whole valley was watered and powered by a handful of enormous dams holding back millions of tons of water in great stone reservoirs.
Knock down those dams, Wallace figured, and you don't just make a mess. You cut the water for the steel mills. You cut the hydroelectric power. You flood the factories and the rail lines and the coal pits. You reach right into the guts of the enemy's ability to make war. Trouble was, you couldn't knock those dams down. People had done the math. They were curved walls of masonry, some of them 130 feet thick at the base. A conventional bomb dropped from altitude would just miss or bounce off or blow a chip out of the face and accomplish nothing. And you couldn't dive bomb them either because the Germans knew exactly how valuable those dams were. They'd strung heavy anti-aircraft guns around them, and they'd hung torpedo nets down deep in the water in front of the dam wall, so no torpedo could ever reach the base. So here's the problem in a nutshell. You need to put a very large charge right up against the face of the dam, deep under the water, so the pressure of the explosion channels into the wall instead of dissipating into open air. But you can't get a torpedo through the nets, and you can't drop a bomb accurately enough from up high. Now here's where it gets interesting. Barnes Wallace is sitting at home, and the story goes, he's watching his own children skip stones across the water. Flat stones thrown low and fast, skittering across the surface. Bounce, 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 and a thought lodges in his brain and won't let go. What if a bomb could do that? What if you could skip a bomb across the water, over the top of the torpedo nets, let it hop along until it kisses the face of the dam, and then let it sink down against the wall before it goes off?
That's exactly what he built. A great cylindrical drum of a bomb, packed with about 6,000 pounds of explosive. And before you dropped it, a belt drive in the belly of the airplane would spin that drum backwards, up to 500 revolutions a minute. That backspin did two things. It kept the bomb skipping true across the water, and when it finally hit the dam, that spin would crawl it down the face, right down against the masonry, before a hydrostatic pistol, a depth fuse, set it off at 30 feet under the surface. The thing was codenamed Upkeep. The men who had to load it and drop it just called it the bouncing bomb. But a clever bomb is only half the story, because a bomb like that only works if you deliver it under conditions that would make any sane pilot break out in a cold sweat. To skip properly, that drum had to leave the airplane at precisely 232 miles an hour, at precisely 60 feet above the water, at precisely the right distance from the dam. Get any one of those wrong and the whole thing fails. Too high, the bomb shatters when it hits the water. Too fast or too slow, it won't skip right. Too far or too close, it won't settle against the wall. 60 feet. Over black water, at night, with flak coming up at you. Now how in the world do you fly an airplane at exactly 60 feet in the dark? You can't trust the altimeter. A barometric altimeter at 60 feet, over water you've never seen at night, is a liar. It'll kill you. The solution was so simple, it's almost beautiful. They took two spotlights and mounted them on the belly of the bomber. One forward, one aft, and they angled them so the two beams would converge and touch, form a single figure eight of light on the surface of the water at exactly 60 feet.
So the navigator would lie there in the nose, looking out the side, and he'd call the descent. And when those two pools of light slid together and became one on the water below, the pilot held it right there. The airplane was flying itself along an invisible rail, 60 feet over the reservoir, marked by nothing but two circles of light.
And the range, the distance to the dam? Another beautiful bit of low-tech genius. On some of the airplanes, they used a little wooden triangle, a handheld sight with two nails sticking up. You lined up the two towers on top of the dam through those two nails, and when the towers lined up with the nails, you were exactly the right distance out. You pressed the release, that's it. A wooden Y with two nails, aiming a 6,000-pound weapon against a national target defended by everything the enemy had back. When Evegas was cheap and airspace was free, we used to say flying was equal parts science and seat of the pants. This raid was both, wound so tight together, you couldn't tell them apart.
Now the airplane. Oh, the airplane. They flew the Avro Lancaster. If you don't know the Lank, let me paint her for you. Four Rolls-Royce Merlin engines, the same magnificent power plant that sang in the Spitfire, only here you've got four of them, a bomber, but a graceful one, long and lean with a great slab of a wing. On a normal night, she carried her bombs tucked up inside a long belly, but these Lancasters were special. They were cut and modified, the bomb doors taken clean off, the gun turret in the middle removed, the whole airplane lightened and reworked to carry that one enormous spinning drum slung underneath in a special cradle. Type 464. They called the modification, provisioning for upkeep. The squadron itself didn't even exist a couple of months before the raid. They stood it up special, in secret, at a place called Scampton in Lincolnshire, No. 617 Squadron. And to lead it, they picked a 24-year-old wing commander named Guy Gibson. 24 years old, he'd already flown something like 170 operations, bomber and night fighter both. By the time most young men today are finishing college, they handed him a squadron of hand-picked crews, told him almost nothing about the target, and put them to work flying low, lower than they'd ever flown. Night after night, down on the deck, across the English countryside and the reservoirs, learning to hold an airplane steady at 60 feet until it became instinct.
The crews came from all over. English lads, yes, but Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders, Americans flying with the Royal Air Force, kids, most of them by our standards. 19, 20, 21 years old, sitting in the cold aluminum belly of a bomber, about to do something nobody had ever done. The night comes. The 16th into the 17th of May, 19 Lancasters split into three waves, lift off from Scampton and turn for occupied Europe, flying so low the whole way that navigation is done by eyeball and stopwatch, and the shape of a river in the moonlight, and it cost them from the very start. Flying at that height leaves you no room. One airplane clips the sea crossing the coast and loses its bomb. Another hits power lines. Another is caught by flak. Men are dying before they ever see a dam, snagged out of the sky by the very ground they were skimming to stay safe. The first main target was the Monet Dam, a huge curved wall holding back a reservoir that stretched for miles. Gibson brings his airplane down onto the water, lines up, gets the spotlights to kiss, holds 232 miles an hour, and runs straight in toward the guns on the towers. The flak reaches up for him, tracer floating up slow and then screaming past. He holds it, steady. The bomb drops, spinning, skips across the surface, and detonates against the wall in a great white column of water that climbs 1,000 feet into the night air. And the dam holds. One bomb isn't enough. So Gibson does something I want you to really sit with. He knows the next crew coming in is going to have to fly that same run, straight into those same guns. So Gibson flies his empty airplane back and forth alongside the dam, drawing the fire, pulling the gunner's aim onto himself, so the man making the drop has a cleaner run. Turns his own airplane into a decoy. One crew after another comes down onto that black water. Some drop true, one is hit, and goes down in flames. And on the fifth run, the fifth bomb of the night against the Monet, the wall finally lets go.
The men in the air said you could see it in the moonlight. A gap tearing open in the dam, and behind it a wall of water, millions of tons of it, bursting through and rolling down the valley in a flood you could not have imagined. One crewman said it looked like the whole valley was filling up with moving silver. They weren't done. The airplanes that still had bombs pressed onto the Eder Dam, tucked down in a twisting valley so tight the pilots had to dive over a castle on a hill, drop into the gorge level at 60 feet, make the drop, and haul back on the yoke to climb out the other side before the far hills killed them. That's not a bomb run. That's a roller coaster flown blind in the dark in a bomber. And they breached the Eder too. The Sorp, the third dam, was a different kind of animal, an earthen dam, and it took hits but held, but two of the great Ruhr dams were broken open that night,
and the flood that followed did exactly what Barnes Wallace had dreamed it would. Power stations drowned, factories flooded, rail lines and roads washed out, water gone from the valley the industry depended on. Now, I'm not going to stand here and tell you it won the war, because it didn't, and honest history never claims it did. The Germans repaired those dams faster than anyone expected, the strategic effect faded, and the price was terrible. On both sides of the 19 airplanes that went out, 8 did not come home. 53 young men were killed in a single night, more than a third of the men who flew the raid. And in the valleys below, the flood took the lives of many people on the ground, including prisoners and forced laborers who had no say in any of it. That's the true cost, and I'll never dress it up.
But here's what that night proved, and why we still talk about it 80-some years later. It proved that a precision problem everyone said was impossible could be solved, not with more tonnage, not with brute force, but with one engineer skipping stones in his head and a squadron of young men willing to fly an airplane down to 60 feet in the dark and hold it there while the sky lit up around them. It was flying, real flying, hand and eye and nerve, taken right to the ragged edge of what a human being and a machine can do together. Guy Gibson got the Victoria Cross for that night. He didn't live to see the end of the war. He was killed on operations the following year, still flying, still leading, at 26 years old. And that little tweed-jacketed engineer, Barnes Wallace, they say the losses haunted him the rest of his life. He'd built the thing that worked, and he never forgot what it cost the men who carried it. So the next time you're out there practicing, holding altitude to within a few feet on a check ride and feeling the pressure of it, I want you to remember a 19-year-old navigator lying in the nose of a Lancaster, calling the spotlights together over Blackwater, 60 feet down, with the guns coming up. That's the heritage we fly under, every one of us. The details of Operation Chastise come to us from the Royal Air Force's own histories and the records of 617 Squadron, and from the accounts the surviving crews left behind over the years. If you want to read more, wander over to RadioHangar.com when you get a minute. This is Taildragger. Keep your airspeed up and your stories closer. I'll see you back here in the hangar.